There's a couple of words that people talk about a lot today, and that's relationship stability. Have you heard of that before? A lot of people will go to great lengths to make sure that they are compatible with someone. They will even fill out information about themselves online and hope that a website could partner them up with somebody that they could have a long-lasting, stable relationship with. It's amazing to me that very few people ever think to apply that concept to their relationship with God. But that's exactly the question that King David posed in Psalm 15. I'd like you to open up to Psalm 15 with me, and I want to look at the question that he writes to the people who would use this in worship, beginning in verse 1. In Psalm 15 and verse 1, David poses this question, O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? At the very end of the psalm, in the last line, he says, He who does these things will never be shaken. You've got three words there, or three phrases, that emphasize this idea of stability. He mentions in verse 1, abide, dwell, and then at the very end of the psalm, never be shaken. Really what David is asking is, what makes for a stable relationship with God? We want to make that a little bit more personal. We want to know who can have a stable relationship with God. In verse 1, when he says, who may abide in your tent, that's probably a reference to the tabernacle. And nobody actually lived in the tabernacle. So you know that David is using some imagery here. He goes on to say, who may dwell on your holy hill? All kinds of people lived on Mount Zion. So he's not really asking what kind of people can buy a piece of property and set up a home there. That's not really what he wants to know. He's looking at two things that represent the Jewish people's relationship with God. And he's trying to see what kind of person can get close to God by using this imagery that he has here. Again, at the end of the psalm, when he mentions never being shaken, he's talking about a relationship that will last. And that's why I use the word stable or stability to describe it. And maybe you think this is not a question you need to concern yourself with. Maybe you think it's just not worth considering. It's not something that you need to worry about, probably at all. If you think like that, then you're making a mistake that the Jewish people made time and again. I want you to hold your place here in Psalm 15. We're going to come back to it, and I want you to turn with me to Jeremiah chapter 7. Jeremiah chapter 7. Everybody has a relationship with God, but not everybody has a good relationship with Him. And you know that sometimes it's God's people who have the worst relationship with their Lord, with their Savior. In Jeremiah chapter 7, God speaks to this problem by sending Jeremiah to talk to the people and to warn them about some judgment that was going to come. He tells them in verse 2, Stand in the gate of the Lord's house and proclaim there this word and say, Hear the word of the Lord, all you of Judah, who enter by these gates to worship the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, amend your ways and your deeds, and I will let you dwell in this place. Do not trust in deceptive words, saying, This is the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord. That sounds really weird to us, but what Jeremiah is saying is you can't make the mistake of thinking that the thing that is an indicator of your relationship with God is more important than your relationship with God. These people are saying, judgment's not going to come to us. We have the temple. We're God's people. He's not going to get so upset and angry as to pour out His wrath upon us. And we don't live in a moment where we have prophets warning us about judgment that's going to come upon us. But we make the same mistake. We don't concern ourselves at times with building a personal, stable relationship with God because we say, I've been baptized. I go to church. I'm a member of the Church of Christ in Humble. Why do I need to concern myself with questions like the one that David wrote about in Psalm 15? We need to concern ourselves with these kinds of questions because we don't want to fall into the same trap that God's people did for thousands of years. It's not good enough to say, this is where I go to church. It's not good enough to say, I've had my sins forgiven. That's not good enough. We need to find out what makes for a stable relationship with God. So turn with me, please, back to Psalm 15. As we read through this psalm, we're going to look at four observations that David makes as to who may dwell on God's holy hill. And what we really want to do, each one of us, privately, independently, is look through this list and look at the things that David says will characterize a stable relationship and find out, is this true of me? Could I describe my relationship with God in these terms? And if not, then I need to make some changes. Because I want to be someone who can abide in his tent. I want to be someone who can dwell on his holy hill. I want to never be shaken from my relationship with Jehovah through his son Jesus Christ. So if you're back in Psalm 15, look with me in verse 2. This is the first thing that David says is necessary to having a stable relationship with God. He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. Those first two statements are the same idea, just put in different words. Walking with integrity, working righteousness, they're the same thing. The third thing that he mentions, he's building on the idea. Here's what I mean. Who speaks truth in his heart. And we might think that David would argue, you need to speak truth to your neighbor. And that's true, but that's not what he's talking about here. This is an introspective quality. In other words, it's assessing yourself to see if you are really the person that you present yourself to be. Do people look at you and is it true that they can say that what they see is what they get? That's what David is starting off here with. He speaks truth in his heart. You cannot be a two-faced, backstabbing, treacherous person and hope to have a stable relationship with God. You have to be the anti-Judas, if you will. David is saying you must be a person of righteous integrity in your heart if you want to have a stable relationship with God. This is the kind of integrity that Job had. Job argued for his integrity for several chapters in the book of Job. He didn't have to. It wasn't like God didn't know how righteous he was, but he felt that he needed to defend himself because God was being unjust. And Job is remarkable because he could stand there and he could tell his friends who were wrong and who kept saying, you've sinned, Job. He could say, that's not true. I'm not saying I'm perfect, but I know that I have tried as hard as I could to be the same man both without and within. I've tried to be a person of integrity. In fact, that word integrity is a key word that comes up over and over in the story of Job. That's the kind of person that David is saying can never be shaken from their relationship with God. This is the same thing that Jesus Christ taught. Hold your place here with me, and I want you to turn with me to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, as you know, is the Sermon on the Mount. That's what we often call this message that Jesus preached. And there's nothing wrong with that. The problem is, though, I think sometimes we remember more about where the lesson took place and where it was given than we can remember what it's actually about. There's a contrast that Jesus sets up in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 20. Look with me in verse 20. This is the contrast that he works throughout the majority of the lesson. He tells his audience, I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. This is the standard of so-called righteousness in your day, the Pharisees, a group of men that Jesus called hypocrites about seven times in Matthew 23. You've got to be better than that. And when he sets up this sermon in the first place to get their attention, he gives what we call the Beatitudes. Look in verse 6. This is a quality that the Pharisees lacked. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. You don't want to be people who just look like they're full. You don't want to be people who just look like they've had their share of righteousness. You want to be someone of righteous integrity in the heart, who genuinely wants to have these qualities and seeks for them and possesses them. That's what David argues for in his psalm. This is what Jesus preached in this great sermon about the righteousness of his citizens within his kingdom. You know, this is the exact opposite of the way that King Saul conducted himself? Last night we were in 1 Samuel 15. We looked at the moment when God told him through Samuel to go and destroy the Amalekites. You know that he didn't fulfill all those instructions. In 1 Samuel 15, when Samuel confronts Saul about his failure to obey, we have a couple of confessions from the king. But even the king's confessions were just a cloak to hide his culpability, his responsibility. He was trying to avoid and dodge guilt, not really to confess it. In 1 Samuel 15 and verse 24, Saul said to Samuel, "I have sinned." Well, that sounds great, but just keep reading. "I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord and your words because I feared the people and listened to their voice." So this is not the kind of attitude of heart that David argues for in Psalm 15. Saul was not really concerned with righteousness. But on the exterior, it kind of looked like it, didn't it? Later on in the chapter, in verse 30, he said, "I have sinned, but please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel, and go back with me that I may worship the Lord your God. I'm going to confess that I'm guilty, but it's really just to spare me embarrassment." This is not the way that David confessed his sin. When Nathan the prophet went to David, David said three words: "I have sinned." That's righteous integrity in the heart. It is the pursuit of righteousness, of God's standard, and trying to be right with Him without trying to get around any personal failings. Look with me in 2 Samuel chapter 21. Chapter 22, 2 Samuel chapter 22. This is one of the great psalms of deliverance that King David composed within his lifetime. And in 2 Samuel chapter 22, beginning in verse 21, he tells us that the Lord has rewarded me. Why? According to my kingship, according to my circumcision in the covenant of Abraham, according to being a Jew? None of those things. None of the symbols of the relationship are important. He said, "The Lord has rewarded me according to my righteousness. According to the cleanness of my hands, He has recompensed me. For I have kept the ways of the Lord and have not acted wickedly against my God. For all His ordinances were before me, and as for His statutes, I did not depart from them." Now don't misunderstand the man. He's not saying he's never sinned. And that's not what I'm saying we have to attain to either. He's just saying, in my heart, I had an attitude that sought as best I could, as consistently as I could, to simply be a man who gave constant thought and devotion to what God required of me. He said in verse 24, "I also was blameless toward Him, and I kept myself from my iniquity. Therefore, the Lord has recompensed me according to my righteousness, according to my cleanness before His eyes." If you want to have a stable relationship with God, you have to be a person of righteous integrity in the heart. And the Lord will recompense you for it. He will bless you for it, according to what David himself is trying to achieve and receive in Psalm 15. That's our first point, being a person of righteous integrity within the heart. Turn back with me to Psalm 15. We want to look at the second thing that David mentions in this prayer. Psalm 15 and verse 3. From here on, every single thing that David lists is about how you interact and deal with other people. He says in verse 3, "He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend." If you look in the middle of verse 3, I guess we could pluck that statement out and we could say, this is it. He does no evil to his neighbor. And that's true, but by itself, that's just kind of generic. I mean, how do we apply it? That's really not what he's talking about here. David doesn't mean something very general. He means something very specific. He doesn't slander with his tongue. He's saying, you want to have a stable relationship with God? Then you better do this. Don't sin against your neighbor with your mouth. So that means when I go home, when you go home, and behind closed doors, the way you talk to your family, God takes that into consideration when he tries to determine whether or not we've got a good relationship with him. Slandering with his tongue against his neighbor. I wonder why the people of God could be considered guilty of this. You think of all the people in the world, it would not be those who try to walk with God, right? But I want to show you something in Exodus chapter 23. Look with me in Exodus chapter 23. Do you want to have a stable relationship with God? Then do this. Represent other people fairly. In Exodus chapter 23, I want you to look in verse 2. In verse 2, Moses says, "You shall not follow the masses in doing evil." Now I could pluck that out, and I could ignore everything else Moses said, and I could give a lesson on how you shouldn't do drugs, you shouldn't sleep around, you shouldn't cheat on your finances or anything like that. I could do all that, and then Steve would rake me over the coals when I got to his house later today. I want you to look in verse 1. Moses says, "You shall not bear a false report. Do not join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow the masses in doing evil." He's got one thing in particular in mind, and that's representing your neighbor fairly. One reason why we are so often guilty of not doing that is we just hear things that other people say, and if 10 people say it, if 15 people say it, it just must be true. And if 15 people are passing it along, then I've got to do my part and pass it along too and tell somebody else about it. That's not the way it needs to be. You hear things about people, you need to stop and investigate them. But I got to tell you, God's people sometimes are so guilty about doing this to their own. It's interesting that David says in Psalm 15, a person who has a stable relationship with God, he does not take up a reproach against his friend. Sometimes we do with our friends what Moses says here in Exodus 23, and I guess maybe it's because we think, I'm this person's friend, and if everybody else is chewing them out, that gives me the right to do it too. If everybody else is saying something about them, I need to be the one saying it too. I've just got to blow the trumpet harder. I don't know why we think like that, but I know I've been guilty of it. I don't know why we do that, but I know that if I do it, it's going to jeopardize my relationship with God, much less the harm it's going to do to my friend. Why would I do that? Look with me in 2 Samuel chapter 10. 2 Samuel chapter 10. When we talk about representing other people fairly, about not sinning against our neighbor, our friend with our tongues, one of the things that we have to make sure we don't do is trying to twist someone's motives. That's a trap that a lot of people fall into. If you look in 2 Samuel chapter 10, in verse 1 we are told that the king of the Ammonites had died, so Hanun his son assumes the throne. David in verse 2 says, "I will show kindness to Hanun, the son of Nahash, just as his father showed kindness to me." So David sent some of his servants to console him concerning his father. But when David's servants came to the land of the Ammonites, the princes of the Ammonites said to Hanun their lord, "Do you think that David is honoring your father because he has sent consolers to you? Has David not sent his servants to you in order to search the city, to spy it out, and to overthrow it? You really think he's your friend? Do you think that's why he sent people here?" Very common mistake. The sad thing is, this led to a war. It leads to fighting among God's people today, too, when we say things like, "You're just saying that to hurt me," or "You didn't really mean it." What kind of game are you playing? Why would you say something like that? We make those mistakes in our relationships with others. And it leads to some angry words being traded that never should have been fired in the first place, just simply because we didn't take somebody at their word. David says if you want to have a stable relationship with God, you can't be this kind of person who slanders with your tongue. You need to represent other people fairly. And I want to offer one piece of advice to help us do that. That's found in Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. and verse 25. Paul tells the church at Ephesus in verse 25, "Therefore, laying aside falsehood, speak truth each one of you with his neighbor, for lying is wrong." That's not what my translation says either. Why does he want people to speak truth about their neighbor? "For we are members of one another." If you read down to verse 31, you're going to find that what he means by that is we are members one for the benefit of another. There are several things in the remainder of this chapter that Paul tells people to do for the benefit of other people. So really, that has to be what he's arguing for with the way that they speak about one another. So when I am faced with an opportunity to say something about my brother or my neighbor, what I need to ask myself before I open my big mouth is what I'm about to say going to help them? Is it going to be beneficial for them, for their reputation? Or are my words going to hurt? If I stop and ask myself that, and if I live according to that, not only will it improve my relationship with others, but it's going to guarantee that I have a stable relationship with God. That's what David says in Psalm 15. So we've got two things so far. Do you want to have a stable relationship with God? Then you simply need to be a person of righteous integrity in the heart, and you cannot sin against your neighbor with your tongue. But there's a third thing that he mentions back in Psalm 15, this time in verse 4. In verse 4, David tells us, "In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord." That tells you, in that contrast, what a reprobate is. We could come up with any definition we wanted to as to what that word means, but he's got a pretty clear idea in mind. He wants you to honor those who fear the Lord. That is, there are some people in life who are pretty concerned about having a stable relationship with God, and there are other people who aren't. Now, of those two groups of people, which should I bestow the greater honor? And we have to wonder, I think, when you read things like this, why would God's people give greater honor to those who don't care about the Lord? And I mean, they don't care about Him in the most flippant, disrespectful, irreverent way possible. You try to talk to them about the will of God and they say, "I don't believe in that God. Your God's crazy. He's unjust." You try to talk to them about God and they say, "You want me to serve some God who threatens to send some people to hell? Who cares about the way I use my mouth, my tongue? I'm going to say whatever I want. I'm going to live however I want. I don't care how it affects my neighbor." I mean, people who completely have no sense of moral foundation whatsoever. Why would we do that? I can think of one area where we tend to fall short, and I think that's with family. When there is an opportunity for someone to give a word of encouragement to someone who is trying to serve the Lord, but perhaps their will to serve God is at odds with the will of another who wants to aggressively oppose the will of God. They intend to stand in the way of it. Maybe we feel divided in our allegiance, and maybe we want to serve this other person. What if they have never obeyed the Lord in the first place? And what if they are that way because they've left the Lord, and they're bitter about Him, and they're bitter about His people, and they want to tear down your faith, they want to be a stumbling block? What do you do then? David says, I'll read it one more time, "If you want to have a stable relationship with God, then in your eyes a reprobate is to be despised," meaning you cannot show them greater honor, you cannot show them greater preference than those who seek to be right with God. Now, I want to make clear, I am not saying that because someone is opposed to the will of God, because they try to tear down your faith, and because they want to lead you off into sin, I'm not saying that gives you a right to say, "I don't have any obligation to you." Look with me at Mark chapter 7. In Mark chapter 7 and verse 9, Jesus is yet again rebuking the Pharisees and the tradition of the elders. He says in Mark chapter 7 and verse 9, "You are experts at setting aside the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. He said experts, but that was not a compliment. He said in verse 10, Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father or his mother, whatever I have that would help you is korban, that is to say, given to God, you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or his mother, thus invalidating the word of God by your tradition which you've handed down. And you do many things such as that. I think there's times when we think we can skirt our obligations to family just because we can throw out a Bible passage and say that we're trying to be more holy to God. Shame on us if we think that's how we can live and get away with it. That's going to jeopardize my relationship with God. That's not what we need to do. No, what I'm saying is, no matter what, no matter what, no matter who it is in the family, no matter what obligations we may have to them, I must always give greater preference to the Lord and His will, and even to His people who seek to do the Father's will over any person that I may have by blood in my life who wants to make sure that the will of God is not kept. Look with me in Judges chapter 6. Judges chapter 6 and verse 25. We're jumping into a story in the life of Gideon. Gideon, of course, lived during a time when the people of Israel worshipped idols. And we're not talking about people who just don't know the will of God, but were neighborly all the same, who wouldn't have cared if you were out there trying to do the will of God. These are people who were giving into idols that were at conflict with the will of God, and it led them to do things in their character that were violently opposed to the will of God upon occasion. And in Judges chapter 6 and verse 25, the Lord tells Gideon, take your father's bull and a second bull 7 years old and pull down the altar of Baal which belongs to your father and cut down the Asherah that is beside it. Build an altar to the Lord, your God, on the top of this stronghold in an orderly manner. In verse 27, we see that Gideon took 10 men of his servants and did as the Lord had spoken to him. For Gideon, blood was not thicker. Well, for us, at times I believe that blood is thicker than the blood of Christ. Gideon didn't know Christ yet, but he wasn't going to live that way. I wonder if when David wrote Psalm 15, he maybe thought about his friend Jonathan. In 1 Samuel chapter 20, we see a very tragic portrait of a reprobate. I'm talking about King Saul. I'm talking about David's father-in-law. I'm talking about Jonathan's dad. This man has completely abandoned God to the point that he's willing to resort to murder. In 1 Samuel 20 and verse 1, David is bemoaning what happened, and he says to Jonathan, what have I done? What is my iniquity? What is my sin before your father that he is seeking my life? He said to him, far from it, you shall not die. Behold, my father does nothing either great or small without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me? Is it not so? Yet David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, or he will be grieved. But truly, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. Then Jonathan said to David, whatever you say, I will do for you. Do you have this kind of burning desire to have a stable relationship with your God? I don't envy Jonathan at all. I would never want to have to make that choice. But do you think you could find the strength or the will to do it? What I'm asking you is the same thing that David is asking in Psalm 15. How much does it matter to you to be right with God? If your own family wanted you to turn your back upon the Lord, wanted you to make sure that you kept their will over the Father's, what would you do? Who can have a stable relationship with God? Simply put in Psalm 15, a person who gives preference to those who live a life of reverence for God. There's one more thing that David mentions that's found back in Psalm 15 and verse 5. starting at the end of verse 4 and going down into verse 5. Who can have a stable relationship with God? First of all, a person with righteous integrity in their heart. Secondly, one who does not sin against their neighbor with their tongue. Thirdly, one who gives preference to those who fear the Lord over those that don't. And finally, he says at the end of verse 4, he swears to his own hurt and does not change. That sounds a lot like Jonathan. Wouldn't you love to have a friend like Jonathan? Better question. What if I am a friend like Jonathan? If I'm a friend like Jonathan, that's going to make sure that I have a friend in God. That's going to make sure I have a stable relationship with him. But David's got something a little more specific in mind. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. Oh, that's a little more touchy, isn't it? Who can have a stable relationship with God? A person who doesn't break his word, even if it means taking a financial loss. You know, the Jewish people had some pretty particular laws about how they use their money. In Deuteronomy 16, you find the things that David is talking about here. Deuteronomy chapter 16, and in verse 19, Moses is talking about judges and the standard by which they were to execute justice among the people. He says in verse 19, you shall not distort justice. You shall not be partial. You shall not take a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and perverts the words of the righteous. Justice and only justice you shall pursue, that you may live and possess the land which the Lord your God has given you. Later on in chapter 23, he tells them in chapter 23 and verse 19, chapter 23 and verse 19, you shall not charge interest to your countrymen, interest on money, food, or anything that may be loaned at interest. You may charge interest to a foreigner, but to your countrymen you shall not charge interest, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land which you are about to enter to possess. Pretty strict rules. Pretty plain, pretty obvious. Pretty easy to keep, I would suspect, unless you needed money. Maybe you loaned out some money to your neighbor, to your countrymen. And when it came time for them to repay, you realized that maybe you didn't manage your own finances as well as you ought to, and you're kind of behind on the bills. Don't you think you'd be a little bit tempted to charge some interest on that money and cover your losses? What if you were a judge? What if you were a poor judge? I suspect a bribe could be mighty appealing and enticing for many people. You don't have to sit as a judge among spiritual Israel today, not like these men did. And it's not considered sinful for us to charge interest on our own loans. But there's some other points of application that we could make based on the things that David wrote about here. What if you turned down a job, men? What if you turned down a job that promised greater pay? You turned it down because you knew that if you took the job, it would take you away from your wife and your kids for far too long. Would that please God? Would that help you maintain a stable relationship with God? What if, brethren, what if you turned down a job offer someplace else? This is going to be a great job. You were going to have retirement. You were going to have insurance. You were going to have a great place to live, pretty weather. It was just going to be great. You turned it down, though, because you knew that the place you were going to have to move to work there would take you away from God's people. No church you could work with. No place to go and to build your faith with other people of like mind. Would that please God? What if a dispute came about in this church between two families? And what if the family who wronged the other, what if they put more in the plate on Sunday? You know, some people would be awfully tempted to make sure that those people got their way, because when they leave, that's going to be a big hit. That's money that you're going to lose. That's revenue vanished overnight. Should we pervert justice? Should elders rule in the favor of an erring family just to make sure that the church bank account is safe and stable? May it never be. David says, if you want to have a stable relationship with God, you cannot break your word, even if it's going to make you lose some money. You cannot do it. I want you to go back with me to Psalm 15. It's merely five verses long. I don't know what it sounded like when Jews sang from this book, but I'd imagine it didn't take them too long to get through it. A couple of minutes to read it. There's an awful lot packed in there. There's an awful lot packed in there that applies to me. O Lord, who may abide in your tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? What David's really asking is, how do I do it? How do I make sure that I'm the one who has a right relationship with you? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. Is that you? Are you the same person within and without? Do you genuinely seek hunger and thirst for righteousness? Do you just want to know? Do you want to know the answer to questions like this that David is posing? What can I do to be right with God? He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. Maybe that's not been you, but it can be. Are you determined to control your mouth, to watch what you say about your neighbor or your friend? In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord? Maybe you've not been as diligent to give preference to your brethren because of how it might impact your family. I can tell you stories right now, and you've got some here, about people who have made decisions that have cost them dearly at home because they wanted to keep the will of God. Not everybody is so fortunate to have family members who don't serve the Lord that don't also try to keep you from doing it. Could you do it? Would you do it? He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. Would you be willing to lose a lot of money just to make sure that you were right with God? David makes a promise at the end of verse 5. He who does these things will never be shaken from his relationship with God. These four things make for a stable relationship. So I leave you with a question. Does Psalm 15 characterize your relationship with God? If it doesn't, you need to make some changes right now. We're going to stand and sing a song, and we would love to assist you together at this time.